This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Greg McNamee. He is the author of Tortillas, Tiswin, and T-Bones, A Food History of the Southwest. It's a terrific book, and I'm really happy to get a chance to talk to you. Greg, how are you?
Well, thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure.
So you've been, you're not originally from the Southwest, is that correct?
Well, I've been here for longer than I've been anywhere else, but yes, that is correct. I came here from Northern Virginia in 1975 and just haven't quite ever been able to leave.
Well, it's, I guess that says something about you and it says something about the Southwest. I think there are a lot of people who find, and you're in Southern Arizona, I should point out, which is, you know, one of the hotter places in North America. So, I think people who can live there year round are, unusual, let's say a minority of people, out of the vast majority of most Americans tend toward the temperate, I think.
in all things but the ones that count.
That's right. That's right. So this book is a kind of, it is a history of food, obviously, but really it feels to me like almost a history of the Southwest told through the lens of food. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, because food is one of the great pathways into understanding how cultures work and how people get together and trade and live among each other and do all the things that we as humans like to think that we do well.
And you've organized it sort of in a certain way, chronologically, starting, you know, it obviously you're starting with the early, you know, you give an early history of the geology and the geography. I think that's really valuable. It's, you know, the change in the landscape is really important. And the history of what went before tells you a lot about what it's like there today.
Well, yeah. And, one of the things that I had hoped to do in setting the scene in that way was to frame the story in a time of great climate change, which, of course, we're undergoing now, and the first people who came to this part of the world experienced as well. You know, when they arrived in what's now the deserts of the Southwest, they arrived in pretty temperate places with rainfall in most of the Southwest about the same as what Iowa experiences today. And so the climate regime in that period of change forced a great period of adaptation. And of course, you know, in various episodes in climate history, we've seen civilizations rise and fall in the Southwest, the Hohokam and the ancestral Pueblo people, for example, that had built up all those monumental cities and suddenly just disintegrated as great powers in the region. And without wanting to be a prognosticator necessarily, I'm thinking that we're going to be seeing some rise and fall here ourselves pretty soon.
Well, or as we already are, I think, Arizona in particular has had a drought, a significant drought. And of course, when you're in a drought, you never really know how long it is going to last. So you can't really tell if it's a temporal period or a longer lasting climate change. But it does, the evidence is pretty strong that climate change is already affecting the Southwest in particular.
Well, and because I'm so ancient, when I came here, it was a given that it would rain at some point, however briefly, every single month of the year, there would be some rainfall, measurable. And now we just last week had the first rain that we've had in more than 100 days.
Wow.
So, yeah, You know, it sort of feel, you know, on top of the general apocalyptic feel of the entire culture, it kind of just adds on to.
Right. The apocalyptic feel is that's a good term, I think. But now it just I should point out, because this is important in the construct of your book, that your definition of the Southwest is fairly broad. It's a little broader than. I would say some of the guidebooks or travel books treat the region. You know, California is sometimes separated and considered something different, but you've really connected Southern California, Southern Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and West Texas, maybe even pretty farther into East Texas as a region. Maybe you could talk about a little bit about what defines the region the way you see it.
Well, it's a strange thing, but, you know, academicians like to argue about all kinds of things. And one of the great geographic arguments that has raged, really, if that's not too strong a word, but at least for the last 50 years or so in the Southwest, has been, what is the Southwest? You know, some people would include the Oklahoma Panhandle, and some would go into Kansas and this and that. I chose to make a cultural definition, more cultural than geographic as such, which is that it's kind of a triple-tiered definition. First, Native people spoke some indigenous language like Tohono O'odham or Opata or Luiseno or some such thing. Then Spanish-speaking people were the political power. And then third, English-speaking people were the political power. And so if you overlay those on top of one another, you get pretty much my definition of the Southwest anyway, up to and including where I really stretch is to take it up into Northern California, which Northern Californians won't like too much, but culturally the definition works still, all the way up to San Francisco anyway, and then all the way over pretty much into the very western fringes of Louisiana, where in my own mind I draw the line is sort of where the queso blanco or queso fresco or queso chihuahua, the belt where Mexican cheese is eaten regularly, fades into the places where Velveeta is eaten more regularly.
That means, right, you could do a map, I think.
Yeah,
right.
It's kind of one of those isoglosses that right. Linguists use. But in any event, that allows me to leave out most of Utah because Utah didn't have that Spanish-speaking overlay before English speakers came. And by that, I mean, of course, there were Spanish speakers here and there in Utah, but nothing like the kind of political construct that we had elsewhere in New Mexico and places like that.
Right. Yeah, I think it in terms of food, I think that's a good definition as well. I think, you know, I might not have thought of the cheese, maybe thinking of where you would kind of find enchiladas might also be. Although now, so what, and you talk about this in the book, how more broad or broadly distributed Mexican food is now, as are Mexican people in America. And we think of Southwestern food as being principally Mexican, even though I think you do a pretty good job of showing that that's not entirely the case.
Yeah, there is, you know, there are all kinds of shades of Southwestern food, and by my lights, in a very real way, the most definitive of all Southwestern cities is Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales is a place that is, of course, native people speaking various indigenous languages with a Spanish overlay, but the first permanent settlement that we know of there is by two Jewish merchants, the Isaacson brothers, who establish a trading post there. They're from Germany originally. They've crossed over overland on the Gila Trail and wound up in Nogales. And soon after them, you have Maronite Christians from Syria and Arabs from Lebanon and from the Eastern Mediterranean, and soon after that, Greeks, and then more Germans, and more Jews, and more somebody from just about everywhere in the world eventually settles there. And each of those people brings to the table, literally, something different. And one of my favorite restaurants down there, for example, is a place where you can get, you know, you can get a French omelet, or you can get Greek salad, or you can get enchiladas, or you can get Chinese. You can get just anything that you want in this place. And nobody bats an eye that all these very strange and unlike things are on the same menu side by side.
Just like a New Jersey diner.
Well, and I wish we remembered that dynamic. I wish that dynamic were a little better understood outside of our region, and particularly in the powers that be, among the powers that be in Washington right now, that we are definitively multicultural here. And always have been, and I suspect always will be.
Well, and you talked about that too. It struck me the fluidity of the border at one time, and I've heard this, and I've spoken to people who remember when the border in many, many places was not the official issue that it is today. And people could go back and forth. And if you look at places like Laredo, where, you know, part of the city is in Texas and part of the city is in Mexico, or, you know, the way El Paso works, you know, it's just, it used to be much different than it is today. We now have this, you know, really overt, and of course it's in the news every day now, this overt wall building that didn't used to exist there. And so Nogales is, you know, that I thought of, you know, it struck me as a really interesting idea, this place of almost, it was almost metaphysical the way you talked about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, because the mix of the literal and the metaphorical is right there before you at all times. And I will say, perhaps metaphorically speaking, that there is no wall in the world that can stand up to the yearning of the human stomach. You know, as long as there are tacos on, you know, either side of the wall, that wall will fall.
Right.
So I'm not too worried about that. You know, the dreams of emperors have always fallen, but food endures, you know, and the memories of those great powers before they fall away, but we still eat these wonderful things that we've been eating for centuries. And that's the real constant in history, I think. And the great adaptive ability that we show when it comes to the table. You know, the ability when we see somebody sitting next to us who's eating something interesting, we want it too. And that's the real interaction of real people, I think, is we're interested in what each other is eating and generally speaking, in the best of worlds, willing to share.
Well, and I think that's the beauty of cooking for someone, you know, that is that idea that you're giving them something that is more than just sustenance. And that, I think that came up, you know, I thought about that too, in places, other parts of the Southwest that you talked about, where the foodways have intertwined between cultures, which you can still see today. You know, if you go to the hill country of Texas, which is German and Czech, settlers, you know, the food there creates influences all over the state. But what that really means is that people communicated with each other through food. Just as you're saying, you know, someone goes into a restaurant. I think there was a scene in the book where I think, and now I can't remember where it was. Maybe it was Nogales. Someone goes into a restaurant to have a meal and is so enthralled with it, has to tell everyone they know.
That's generally speaking in the restaurant biz, that's what they say, is if somebody likes what they have eaten in a restaurant, they'll tell 10 people, they'll tell one person, but if they dislike it, they'll tell 10 people. So, you know, some place has got to be really good if you've heard of it from the world outside.
Well, of course, now we have, social media, so that if a food truck is really good, everyone chases the food truck on Facebook or Twitter, and including the food truck.
That's exactly right. And it's funny that you should mention that, because as you were mentioning the interactions and the intertwinings of culture around food, I was thinking in particular of the workings of the tamale, you know, which comes up from Central America. It's been eaten in this part of the world for generations on generations, but it's also spread over into the Mississippi Valley, and up through there. You know, native people were eating something like tamales probably before Europeans arrived. But it turns up then by way of that Native American intermediary in African American cuisine of the Mississippi Delta. So you've got that Robert Johnson song, that great blues song about, you know, red hots.
Right.
And, you know, he's talking about those red hot tamales. He's talking about more than that, of course. But the last time I was in southern Mississippi, I just about fell out of my car when I saw a tamale food truck and, in an African-American neighborhood doing a thriving trade, and just had to stop and have a tamale. And of course, it wasn't quite the same as what we eat here, but it sure was good.
Well, it is interesting, too, when you talk about that, you know, I've been interested in the Mississippian culture and, you know, the whole dynamic of sharing and cultural motion between the Mississippi River Basin or Mississippi River Valley and Mexico, with the sun worshiping cultures of Aztec and Mississippian, trying to figure out who influenced whom, which one came first is really difficult to figure out. But you can see that the travel of food may document the travel, or it certainly documents the travel of people, both in modern times and in ancient times.
Yeah, and there is some very interesting scholarly work that's being done there, and some of it's a bit conjectural, but like linguistic reconstruction, for example, watching how terms for things like chilies spread and how they move from language to language along with the thing itself. Up in the Mississippian Valley, again, before Europeans arrived, probably in places as far north as Cahokia and, you know, those mound building peoples up in the, in Illinois and such, they're growing chilies too. So, right. You know, this is nothing new. I have a friend in Virginia who's growing an abundant crop there, and, thinking that's, you know, we're just, you know, taking it state by state. Pretty soon we'll conquer Canada. And, and then the world will be ours.
Well, and of course that relates back to the notion of, and you talk about this, of water and, you know, whether there is going to be enough water in the Southwest in general for agriculture, and whether that sort of means maybe and as the climate changes, maybe some of the agricultural products that we think of as Southwestern end up migrating north, just as you're suggesting. One of the things you talked about that I hadn't really focused on, because I'm not around the Southwest so much, is this idea that agricultural entities that control water are selling it, literally, their water rights to the cities. And I thought that was really interesting, you know, that you could, we think of California as the richest agricultural area in the world, just about. But what if the, and you talked about almonds, which are one of the highest water using products there is, you know, what if they don't end up having enough water that they can grow crops with, they sell it to the cities?
Yeah, there's an old saying in the Southwest that water flows uphill toward money.
Yeah.
And that is certainly true. And where the money is in these times is in the great cities. And you get some very strange sights as a result of that. You drive into downtown Phoenix, for example, and, you know, it'll be 105 there today, maybe 107. And yet there are fountains everywhere and jets of water and, you know, pools and lakes. And we treat water as if we lived in the Mississippi Valley or as if we lived in the Northeast, and without much consideration for it. And it will be very interesting to see how it all comes crashing down, because, well, as long as I've lived here, there's been talk that there's tomorrow the water is going to end and it's going to be all over. And somehow we've managed to endure for, you know, a half a century anyway. But I think we really are coming on to some times where people will have to make hard choices about, do we have big cities in the Southwest, or do we have agriculture? Because we can't have both. And if we don't have agriculture, where do we get our food from? And the answer to that is probably from places like South America and maybe even Central Asia, that this food is ported in at great expense. And of course, that means we better not be having any trade wars anytime soon. all of these complex issues that all in revolve around. Now, I say that in that great big scale, and of course, humans have always been interestingly adaptable. And I think that even as that big scale stuff is happening, almost everybody that I know is growing, not quite subsistence level, of course, but certainly supplemental food out of their own gardens down here, and growing very interesting things and restoring heirloom crops and growing drought-tolerant strains of corn and all kinds of things that are happening there. So I don't take a catastrophist view of all this, but I'm sure not much of an optimist either.
Well, and there are adaptations, as you mentioned. You have the notion that we have, you know, if you can't get food from far away, because it's not practical to, and of course it adds more carbon to the atmosphere to transport food, that maybe you could, you know, have a more local food growing economy. But I think, wasn't it Gary Nabin did a book a few years ago about that, I think, where he took a year of trying to eat locally in Arizona within 100 miles of Tucson, I think the diameter was, or the circumference was, and it was really hard to do. And you touch on that in this book as well. One of the things that really struck me was your a little piece you did about the cheeseburger as an impossibility, except in this one particular modern era.
Well, you know, if I had to count all the cheeseburgers I've eaten in this world and think how many I would be able to eat if I were forced to my own devices. And of course, it's impossible, but it's impossible almost any kind of food that we eat. You know, it's said, and I point out in the book, that the supply chain for all the ingredients taken into account that might go into a taco altogether will travel 64,000 miles, you know, so nearly three times the circumference of the Earth, in order to make a single taco, you know, that might have, I'm talking about, of course, you know, not just the supply chain of immediate ingredients, but also the historical chain that brings the chicken from Southeast Asia all the way to the Mediterranean, then all the way across the oceans to the Americas, and things like that. So all of this food depends on a very, very vast chain of connection and of trade, and with any luck of people being peaceable toward each other in order, as I say, to set that wonderful table.
Well, it is true. But I think I love the image of the cheeseburger, maybe particularly a green chili cheeseburger. and what that means, you know, that, and I thought it made me think a lot about how much I think we all do. We take for granted the kind of the living history that our food system is. And that's one of the reasons why I like this book, because it gives you a perspective on what's in front of you all the time. You know, that there's, and I, you know, you, it, it's not an unrevealed history, but it does require some thoughtful understanding of how things got to where they are. And I think you did that really well.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, David. Thank you. Yeah, I certainly enjoyed thinking about the book and writing it. And as I said, one of the great sort of silly epiphanies I had with it was sitting in a diner in New York City at 4 o'clock in the morning, one gray, rainy day, and kind of looking at all the food going by me and being brought back and forth by wait staff that spoke many different languages, most of them Eastern European, and customers from everywhere in the world and cooks from every conceivable continent, and thinking, boy, you know, there's a lot going on here.
Well, I know. And it's good to take a moment to think about that because it is really true. One thing I would love for you to talk about a little bit is, because I don't know how to pronounce it properly, is Tiswin. And maybe you can explain how that fits into the culture a little bit.
Well, yes, and you pronounced it just fine, Tiswin, they call it in Mexico, and farther south in Latin America, they call it chicha.
Right.
So it's sort of a very mild corn beer, and you know, some wag once observed that all cuisine in the end is really based on a dare. You know, I dare you to go and eat that, or I dare you to go and drink that, and if you live, then you know maybe I'll eat it too, or I'll drink it too, and certainly that's true in the case of the domestication of things like the potato and the tomato. And all, but so I imagine somebody who just left a corn cob, a partially eaten corn cob, in a puddle, and you know, a few days later they noticed that this kind of fizzy stuff was coming off the corn cob and kind of dripping into that puddle, and you know, people are curious. We're monkeys of a kind after all, and you know, we'll go over and poke at anything. And somebody went over and tried it and discovered that, well, you know, it's a kind of an interesting, very light buzz resulted from it. And if that's not a constant in history, then I don't know what is. You know, the search for the mild buzz. And that's exactly what Tiswin, you know, you'd have to drink a barrel of it to really get yourself messed up. And so native people using surplus corn would make this as just a light, refreshing drink. And, of course, one of the first things that Americans did when they came here, Anglo-Americans, I mean by that, was to try to suppress Tiswin making because, of course, this is what gets these native people all riled up. When, in fact, what got native people riled up usually was the whiskey that was being sold to them under the counter.
Well, maybe it was an economic thing, you know, to suppress Tiswin in order to make it possible to sell whiskey and beer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in much the same way that the wine growers of Spain petitioned the king to force Mexican people not to grow their own wine grapes for generations so that the winemakers of Spain would have a monopoly in the Mexican market.
Right, right. Oh, actually, that reminded me that I wanted to mention that throughout this book, you've included all sorts of really interesting ephemera like that, you know, sort of ephemeral information like these things that are connected to the story, but are not necessarily, you know, part of the story. And I thought that was really, it made it much more interesting as well.
Well, I have a trivial mind, so, you know, it sort of sucks up oddments of things like that. And I like spinning tales out of them.
Well, that's how you get Linda Ronstadt into a book about Southwestern food. And I'll let readers figure out for themselves how you did that. But I think that was pretty good. Well,
thank you.
I want to ask you one last question. Is, you know, was there anything that you left out of the book that you feel you were sorry to leave out, but you felt you had to do?
In the end, no, I don't really think so. I think I touched on everything that I wanted to do, and I wanted to avoid encyclopedism in that conclusion, particularly. I wanted to sort of leave some of the, you know, some of the possibilities open, because of course no one knows how things are going to wind up. But no, I think the book sort of in an odd way kind of told itself as I was working through it. And you know, if I had added one more chapter to it, it would have meant 20 more pounds on my frame. So,
right, you'd have more research to do.
Exactly.
Right. Well, I think it's a terrific book. It's Tortillas, Tiswin, and T-Bones: A Food History of the Southwest by Gregory McNamee. And I really appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Thank you.